Welcome to today's Capital Forum conference call. I will now turn the program over to Jonathan Rubin. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and thanks to everyone for joining the Capital Forum's conference call on the Comcast-Time Warner cable merger. I'm Jonathan Rubin, Capital Forum's senior correspondent, and with me today is Seth Bloom. Mr. Bloom is an attorney and formerly general counsel to the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee. Currently, he's the principal at Bloom Strategic Counsel, where, among other things, he counsels Comcast regarding the Time Warner Cable merger. Today's call is the third in our series on the Comcast-Time Warner Cable deal, and we'll have another one on July 25th with Jeffrey Mann, author of a recent white paper entitled "Beneficence is Beside the Point, the Antitrust Realities of the Comcast-Time Warner Cable Merger." Before we get started, I'd like to note a few things. I'll spend the first 30 minutes or so interviewing Mr. Bloom. Then we'll turn it over to the audience for questions. If you have a question for us, please email us at editorial at thecapitalforum.com. That's one word, thecapitalforum.com. And with that, let me welcome you, Mr. Bloom, to the Capital Forum.
Well, thank you very much. Thank the Capital Forum for inviting me to participate. And thank you, Jonathan, for doing the interview. Before I get started, I just want to say, as you correctly said, I represent Comcast, but the views I'm going to express today are my own.
Very good. Well, let's jump right in. Let's look at the competitive issues. The likely deal, effect of the deal on competition, of course, is the principal concern of the antitrust agency's review. The merging parties say they don't compete for customers in any market, and they contend that because of that, the combination won't hurt competition. Is this really the beginning and end of the analysis? And if so, why is it expected to take the DOJ and FCC a year to review the deal? It's easy enough to verify that the merging parties won't deprive consumers of a choice of provider, so why is it going to take so long?
Well, I'd like to start by answering the first part of your question. Is this the beginning and the end of the analysis? Well, I think it's about 90% of the analysis that the companies don't compete. And that's the key here. I mean, we have to, cutting through all the tumult over this merger, and I think we have to look at what are the standards, how will this be reviewed? This is going to be reviewed by the Justice Department's Antitrust Division under Section 7 of the Clayton Act. And they're only empowered to examine whether or not this merger is or is not going to significantly injure competition. I think the answer to that as to whether this merger is going to significantly injure competition is very plain, and that is it will not. And I also think that they're going to, so therefore they're not going to find a basis to oppose this merger. So why do I say that it won't significantly injure competition? It's simply because these companies, these two cable companies, Comcast and Time Warner Cable, operate in differing geographic markets. So therefore, no consumer is deprived of a choice of providers, either for television service, pay television service, video services, or for internet connection services. I live in Washington, D.C. My choices are Comcast. My choices are the two satellite companies. I can have RCN, cable overbuilder, or I can do without cable and altogether and try to view things either over the air or through online video distributors. This isn't changed by the fact that Comcast is merging with Time Warner Cable. Likewise, consumers who live in New York City, for example, have Time Warner Cable as their incumbent providers. They have the choice of two satellite companies. They have the choice of Verizon Fios. They have the choice of online video distributors. Again, the fact that Comcast is acquiring Time Warner Cable doesn't change things at all. Just the name of their cable provider changes from Time Warner Cable to Comcast. There's no diminution of consumer choice anywhere in this country. And this applies not just to video competition, but this applies to internet service providers. Because, of course, both Comcast and Time Warner Cable are major providers of internet service. Again, the choices, there's never a choice between Comcast and Time Warner Cable. They don't compete for internet service. So, again, the same analysis is true. I named Washington, New York City, but you can name any city you want. And that's the way it works. So that's the basic thing that the Justice Department will look at. And, in fact, to the best of my recollection, I don't recall ever the Justice Department or the Federal Trade Commission stopping a cable merger. Some of them have been subject to conditions, that's a different story, but actually outright trying to block a merger, as the Justice Department did 3 years ago with AT&T and T-Mobile, it's never happened, to my knowledge. And so your question was, is that the beginning of the end of the analysis? Well, it's not quite. I think it's 90%. But there's a couple other things we have to keep in mind here. First of all, the Justice Department isn't the only agency that reviews this. The Federal Communications Commission reviews it as well. And they look at these same competition standards that the Justice Department does. And I don't think they're going to reach any different conclusion than the one I just did. But they also operate under what's known as the public interest test. And they have to determine whether it's in the public interest. Now, I think this is clearly in the public interest because of all the enhancement and improvement that Comcast is going to bring to Time Warner Cable customers. Things like better the X1 operating system, which is the operating system that Comcast customers have to view video. Deployment of next generation broadband. The best in-home Wi-Fi. More Wi-Fi hotspots. The Internet Essentials program, which gives hundreds of thousands of low-income people access to the Internet for less than $10 a month. The fact that Comcast is subject, the only company in America today subject to the Open Internet Order, which prevents discrimination against in broadband provision. And that's coming out of the Comcast-NBCU merger conditions. That will now go to Time Warner Cable merger, Time Warner Cable customers. For all these reasons and many more, I think this is in the public interest. And the FCC will find it to be in the public interest. And in fact, the consumer experience is enhanced for customers of Time Warner Cable. And so therefore, the FCC, in addition to the fact that there's no harm to competition, will find it to be in the public interest. So then your final question is, so why is it taking so long? Well, I mean, this is a $48 billion merger. The Justice Department, and rightly so, is going to look at this carefully. These are two large companies serving large segments of the country, and it's important. They have to check it out. And it's just in the nature of merger review that they'll take a long time by the Justice Department. And they have to go through the second request process where they request thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of documents, interview a lot of people, receive commentary from all kinds of industry participants, stakeholders, consumer groups. That whole process takes a long time. The fact that it takes a long time really, to me, says absolutely nothing about the merits of whether or not this should survive the merger review process. It's just the nature of every large merger. It takes a long time. The FCC has its own bureaucratic process of merger review, and they have a clock which is supposed to take no longer than 180 days, but it gets stopped. And in fact, the FCC hasn't even open this thing for public comment yet. And they have a much more formal public comment on the record process. It's just in the nature of their statutory mandate to review these kinds of mergers under the public interest test that it just by nature takes a long time. But that doesn't affect, the fact that it's going to take a long time doesn't affect the basic truth of this analysis, that there's really no reason under antitrust law or under FCC communications law to stop this merger, and there is no real concern here.
Well, let me talk about your answer there just a little bit. I want to ask you about the standard. You said the standard is whether this merger will injure competition or not. Isn't the standard actually the incipiency standard? Isn't it a question of whether it may substantially lessen competition? And are you equally as sure about the outcome when you ask the question that way? I mean, are you in fact saying that there's no possibility of any anti-competitive effect from the deal?
Well, I think you actually stated the standard correct under the law, but I do think there is no possibility of anti-competitive effect. I don't see it. When you have, and that's why, as I said, the Justice Department has never stopped a cable merger. When you have companies that don't compete for the consumer's business, and when you have, maybe I should go beyond that. Okay, let's take a look at this marketplace. Over 98% of consumers have the choice of at least three cable providers. You have the choice of the cable provider, the two satellite providers, and then you also have, in recent years, the development of video services provided by the telephone companies. So when you have that, it's hard to imagine that this thing can, in its incipiency, can harm competition. If you look at, and over 35% in 2011 had the choice of four providers, that's including the telephone companies, and the number of telephone subscribers has increased over telephone video subscribers has increased over the years, so now it's probably closer to 50% have at least the choice of four. And in fact, if you interesting things, there's a lot of statistics you can look at. I mean, the reality is cable TV companies have been losing subscribers in recent years. The cable TV share of the pay television market in 1999, which is just 15 years ago, was 87%. Today it's 55.7%. That's really remarkable. Since 2005, cable's down 10.4 million subscribers. I mean, I think what this shows, and at the same time that telco and satellite's up 11.3 million, I think what this shows is that the cable market is a vigorously competitive market. And that doesn't even get into the development over the last 10 years of online video, which is a way that consumers can access a plethora of content without even having a cable television subscription. So, again, if you're talking, I don't see the incipiency. If you want to shift it to broadband, you know, and there's been a sort of a lot of alarmist talk about broadband, but the reality is that, you know, again, in every market we have competition from wired telephone, DSL, and if I can stop there, I've heard commentary that DSL is slower. Well, in fact, the use of DSL over the last 5 years has grown much faster than cable. DSL grew 26% over the last 5 years, more than 50% in terms higher than cable broadband. I mean, if DSL is such a slow service, why is it that people are increasingly using it as an alternative? And I think consumers are voting with their feet here. And actually, the statistic I just quoted you was between December 2008 and December 2012. And then we have, in addition to DSL, we have either the Verizon Fios or the AT&T UVerse system, which is a fiber system with even faster speeds, and that overlaps the Comcast Time Warner Cable footprint in 42% of their footprint. And so, again, I don't see the incipiency there. In addition to that, what about wireless broadband? Wireless broadband. I mean, all you have to do is go look at any subway train, anybody walking down the sidewalk, any restaurant, and you see people accessing the internet, emails, but the internet as well, all over the place, and it's in smartphones, but also in tablets.
So you believe wireless is a substitute for wired broadband?
Well, I think for millions of consumers, it is. Absolutely, it's certainly an alternative way of accessing the internet, and so again, this is
an increase in wired broadband pricing, you believe, will drive consumers to use their wireless devices for broadband connectivity?
I do.
Okay. Let me ask about the other 10%. I understand your answer regarding the timing of the review process,
right,
that it's a big complex merger, and you said 90% of it was taken care of more or less by the lack of overlap on the consumer level. What's the other 10% that the agencies will look at?
Well, I mean, I guess when I was saying the other 10%, I was saying the antitrust thing doesn't take care of it all. The FCC has to look at the public interest factors, and I listed some of them. But in addition to that, okay, there is one area where you could argue that there is some competition that exists, and that is Comcast and Time Warner Cable as purchasers of programming and other services. And so Comcast and Time Warner Cable not as selling to consumers, but as purchasers of programming and purchasers of equipment. So that's probably the other 10%. Now, if you want to look at that, let's look at that. First of all, on the video side, and this argument is mainly about the video side. On the video side, because of divestitures, after this merger, Comcast and Time Warner Cable will have no more than 30% of subscriptions to pay TV. So if you're a programmer, that still leaves 70% of the market available, not Comcast and Time Warner Cable. It's hard to argue that the new Comcast, the combination of Comcast and Time Warner Cable, will have monopsony power, a buyer's monopoly, when it's only got 30%. I mean, you could argue about if it was 70%, but when it's 30%, I don't think there's any argument here.
What if the 30% is all in the East Coast and West Coast urban areas, and the rest of it is in non-urban areas, and you've got programming or advertising that you want to point to in urban areas?
Well, I don't think that's quite accurate that it's like that.
Okay.
But even so, when we're talking about programming, let's put aside advertising, we're talking about programming, it's sold on a national basis, so by and large. And so it doesn't really matter geographically where it's spread out. And think about the purchasing of programming. And this is, you know, consistent with the way I think antitrust regulators look at buyer power, if you want to call it that. Again, at 30%, I have a hard time saying it's buyer power, but going from 22 to 30. But if you have greater buyer power, you're able to get a better deal on the purchase of these things, in this case programming. So if you, what's the number one driver of cable price increases? It is the increased cost of programming. Cost of programming rose between 2004 to the end of 2003 over 120% on a per consumer basis. Over 120%, that's more than doubled. It's hard to imagine an industry that's had an input rise to that level in the space of less than 10 years. It's really an astonishing rate.
Do you expect the merger to be able to put Comcast in a position to place downward pressure on content costs?
That would be, and I'm not an economist by training, I'm a lawyer, but basic economics would teach you that if you have greater power, you can extract better deals from programmers. So it should, under economic theory, at least act as a brake onto programming cost increases.
Well, yeah. What do you say about the waterbed effect, wherein people say, well, if you have buyer power and you're able to suppress the cost of supply, those suppliers will raise the price to rivals. For example, the satellite companies, the other cable companies who are not Comcast or Time Warner, won't be able to have that buyer power. Could they be paying more for content as a result?
Well, it's easy to spin out hypotheticals. I don't have a clear answer to that. But again, these companies need to sell their programming. I mean, if they raise their prices too high, their other distributors won't purchase them. Will purchase less quantity. By the way, and on this question of, I wanted to add and make another point.
Yep.
On this question of buyer power, it's easy to say that it goes from 22 to 30%, but let's not forget, an entirely new cable company is being created by this deal, which is now inartfully called SpinCo. That's what the companies have named it. They'll change the name. Which will be the third largest cable customer.
Yeah, but
cable company.
Don't overlap with any.
Well, but this is on the buyer power question of whether or not there's one less place for programmers to sell their programming. Well, in fact, there's not. Because now we have the addition of SpinCo.
So even though Time Warner might be removed from those markets as a purchaser, you've got SpinCo entering.
Yes, absolutely true.
All right, that's fair enough. Okay. There's little doubt that the merger is being supported and pushed by a significant lobbying effort by the merging parties. But there's also no doubt that there's a lot of opposition to the deal. And one might say that this could be reflected in the candidacy of Zephyr Teachout and Tim Wu up in New York, who seem to be running on an anti-merger platform. So there's something of a disconnect. If the merger is so competitively benign because of the lack of overlap, and consumers won't lose a provider, why is there such opposition among, you know, the populace?
Well, okay.
Or apparent opposition, I should say.
I hear that question, and I don't want to take issue with it, Jonathan, because I respect you a lot, but I think there's opposition to every merger. I'm not sure I accept the premise of the question. I mean, I was at the Senate for almost 14 years, and we reviewed a lot of mergers, and there'd always be some people to come out and oppose it. I mean, this is a merger among major people in the media industry. It sort of attracts a lot of attention. But I don't know. I haven't seen a public opinion poll on this subject. And so I'm not sure the premise of that is correct. There's going to be opposition. You know, some of it, if competitors are complaining, we would say we're sort of not going to credit that because that means...
Well, they are complaining, right? Aren't they? Dish was in the New York Times this morning saying that they're against the deal.
Competitors always complain about a merger. If it creates a stronger competitor, then you sort of... That's not a respectable reason to be concerned. In fact, that shows that it's creating a stronger competitor, which would work to the benefit of consumers. We're concerned about consumers here. I don't know there's any scientific way to measure the opposition, as you put it. I would point out, if we look at the hearings that have been held on Capitol Hill so far, and you know, I guess those are the people's representatives at those hearings, it hasn't attracted a great deal of opposition. I compare it to my own experience 3 years ago when I was the general counsel of the antitrust subcommittee of AT&T T-Mobile, and at this stage of AT&T T-Mobile, say 3 months after our hearing, there was a tremendous amount of opposition, sort of a groundswell. We had sent a letter to the Justice Department and the FCC saying block it. There's been nothing like that. If you looked at the hearings, there was not quite to the contrary, there was not a very critical reception. There was, a well-reasoned reception, a careful reception, but there was a considerable amount of support or, you know, people not expressing a great deal of concern. So I just don't accept the notion that there's this great groundswell of opposition against this merger.
Well, okay, and I'm not sure that measuring the amount of the opposition is the point. I think the question is, what's the opposition about? And
right.
What I think I hear you saying is that they really, there's no there in the opposition.
That's what I'm saying.
And primarily because of this non-overlap business.
Yes. Well, that's right, and yeah. The other reasons that I mentioned.
There's a sense among folks that Comcast, after the merger, will occupy something of a gatekeeper position. You touched on this with respect to the upstream markets, but let's look at advertising for a minute. Doesn't the final deal, when SpinCo is all finished, really put Comcast in the position of being the major cable company for the metropolitan areas on the East Coast, the West Coast, Texas, and Chicago, which are the key commercial areas in the country? Doesn't that mean that Comcast is a must-have, a conduit for advertisers and applications developers and other folks that want to reach those consumers?
Well, I mean, there's many ways for advertisers to reach consumers, and it's not just cable television advertising. Obviously, there's broadcast television advertising, there's newspaper advertising, there's billboard advertising, and radio advertising. And all those other areas, Comcast doesn't have any interest
in. And you would put them all in the same antitrust market?
Well, if you think about, I know traditionally antitrust has looked at each market by market, but I think you have to examine what the market is today. And we've seen a great convergence in technologies, and you know, people seeing advertising on the internet, and people viewing things online. And so if there's an advertisement in a television show that's viewed online, I mean, where is the market there? I think maybe the Justice Department needs to rethink. And I was at the Justice Department back in the late 90s, and we looked at radio mergers, and we'd only look at the radio stations. But I don't think that's realistic today. So I think I would put these in the same market. With the great convergence of technology, I think things have changed.
What is your response? What are your views about the oft-heard comment that the merger will, by expanding Comcast's footprint, simply exacerbate the already recognized vertical problems that were dealt with in the Comcast,
right.
NBC,
well,
Universal deal?
I think the latter part is the key part. They were already dealt with. And I mean, we have all kinds of conditions arising out of the Comcast NBCU merger deliberation, which by and large take care of this problem. You know, conditions that NBCU programming has to be made available on the same terms to competing MVPDs, competing pay TV channels, pay TV networks, pay TV distributors is the way to put it, as it is available to Comcast. Arbitration rights, conditions that Comcast can't deny to legitimate online video distributors programming, and that if there's an issue there, they can go to arbitration. We have all kinds of conditions like that. We have conditions requiring non-discrimination in independent networks being carried on the Comcast systems. So I think all these conditions really take care of any concerns that one has.
So you don't see the competition issues that were addressed by those conditions exacerbated by the larger footprint?
I don't.
Okay.
And I guess the other thing I'd point out is,
yeah,
Comcast has an excellent record with complying with these conditions, has an excellent record in having independent channels on its networks. It has 160 independent channels on its video network, which, and by the way that's defined is channels not in the top 15, that's a lot.
No, I understand.
Have any of
these guys used the conditions, the procedures that are available at the DOJ or the FCC to get onto Comcast? Let me ask the question in a quite slightly different way. I can give you examples of folks that feel that the conditions aren't working. Folks that tried to either get on Comcast or obtain NBC programming, and in fact were met with vigorous litigation by Comcast. Comcast can say that these conditions exist, but of course, if they resist them when they are attempted to be implemented, then they may never get anywhere. Do you know of instances where the conditions have worked to allow someone to either obtain NBC programming or to get on
Comcast?
Well,
you know, I'm not inside Comcast and privy to the business negotiations about how people get on the system. I know the 160 independent networks, I know that.
Were any of them on there because of the conditions?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, so,
I don't know whether that's
related to the conditions or not.
I want to explain that. Yeah. I also know that Comcast was required under the NBCU consent decree to put on 10 new independent channels, and they've got 5 of them on so far, and they're working on the others, and a lot of those are minority-owned. And then in terms of, we'll answer it a little way, I'm unaware of anybody who has a problem who's saying I'm not getting on, other than the ones that either there's two prominent instances. There's Bloomberg, which
the neighborhooding problem.
The neighborhooding problem, and that was just a Bloomberg is on the Comcast system. It was a disagreement about what neighborhooding meant, and ultimately that was resolved, and the whole matter's settled. And then as the Tennis Channel, the other one, which by the way wasn't part of the Comcast NBCU, they were just claiming a violation under the FCC program.
Under the program page.
And the case went up to the D.C. Circuit, and the D.C. Circuit ruled in Comcast's favor to say that there was legitimate business reasons and no discrimination against Tennis Channel. So no, I'm aware that but you think of the hundreds and hundreds of channels being carried and the enormous number of possible disputes, and these are the only two that I'm aware of, and so I think the record is pretty damn good here.
Fair enough. I asked Dr. Moss of the American Antitrust Institute whether unit costs really go down when you make a giant network like Comcast into a very giant network like Comcast Time Warner. So I'll ask you the same thing. Are there really economies of scale at play, and aren't the benefits of the merger really generated through enlarging the firm's scope rather than being able to push the marginal costs of serving a subscriber any lower than it already is?
Well, it's hard to know what's going to happen in the future, but here's what we do know. Let's look at broadband. The cost per megabyte for a consumer has gone down 92% since 2004. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
And you attribute that to what exactly?
Well, you know, and Comcast since that time has grown, and so in terms of greater economies of scale. I mean, I think it goes, and also technological improvements, of course, no technological innovation. But you have to have, let me give you some other statistics. You have to have a certain scale to get in this technologically complex nationwide.
And Comcast isn't there yet,
well,
right? With the millions that they got.
I wouldn't say they're not even there yet, but I think the record of what's happened with scale is pretty impressive. So last year, Comcast invested $6.6 billion, a billion with a B, in upgrading its network. In the last 5 years, they've invested $27.7 billion. I mean, I think that shows you what happens with a company with scale. We could expect this to continue. And we're talking again about a nationwide scope, huge, you know, I don't know how many miles of cable and infrastructure and DOCSIS 3 technology, which are, you know, the new technology for delivering the Internet. I mean, these things are massively expensive. And as I said, the X1 operating system, a new operating system. So I think, these things cost a lot of money. And I think there really are economies of scale, sure, that somebody who runs a cable system of 2 million customers, or even less, 200,000 customers, just isn't going to be able to achieve. Again, I'm not an economist, but Dr. Moss is, and I have a lot of respect for her, but it sort of stands to reason that you will get economies of scale in this kind of business with this kind of thing.
We've had an economist talk to the Capital Forum that said that he thought it was pretty unusual for a company to need 30% of the market to achieve minimum efficient scale, but... The point is you get to a point where costs are low, and they don't get any lower by getting any bigger. And the reason I bring this up is because it seems to me that the benefits of the merger have more to do with scope and geographic coverage and the melding together of servicing various different markets, more than they have to do with the cost for serving a customer.
I'm not an economist, so it's a little bit difficult for me to evaluate that. But I think scope is a fair point that there are definite efficiencies in serving greater geographic areas.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that the technology would be difficult for a smaller cable company to reproduce.
Right.
And you also mentioned that there's never been a successful challenge or maybe even an attempted challenge to a cable merger. That brings up, I think, an important question that was raised on some of our earlier calls, in particular by Alan Grunis, who was our guest here a couple of times ago. And the question is, what is the limiting principle then? Why shouldn't Comcast be allowed simply to purchase every cable company in the country?
It's a very good question, and I respect Alan very much. He's a good friend of mine. So here's what I would say. I mean, if we had a single cable company, then the issue of buyer power would be different. Then we'd have programmers who would have substantially fewer choices than they do today. And we have dozens of cable companies. So I think that's a very... Then we would be getting into an interesting area of buying power. The analysis on the consumer side wouldn't change, but the analysis on that side would change, on the buyer power side. I will also say, and this is, you know, the kind of question that's also often asked of Supreme Court advocates, what about this? And the answer should be, and is, that's not the case we have here today, Your Honor. And it's not. I mean, we don't have a situation where we're acquiring 100% of cable subscribers. We're acquiring 30% at most.
No, but you wouldn't deny that we are. It's legitimate to ask about the fundamental antitrust approach to
right.
the problem
well,
and the implications of it.
In this very hypothetical situation, where you're going to the remaining 70% and all these other companies, then you'd have to look at the effect on the downstream market. But we're nowhere near there. I don't, frankly, think we have to worry about that. I think we have to look at the transaction we have here today. And the transaction we have here today does not raise competition concerns. It's just that simple.
I want to remind our listeners, if they have a question for Mr. Bloom, to send it to us at editorial@thecapitalforum.com. Let's talk a little bit about innovation. You've already mentioned that. The parties have argued that the merger is, if not the only way, the best way to spur innovation. Can we assume that Comcast has done some sort of cost-benefit analysis which shows that more innovation is likely to be generated by buying Time Warner than by investing in research and technology or developing technology directly?
I just don't accept that question. I mean, I don't know what analysis has been done, but I think look, they have, as I said, I feel repeat myself. They've invested a tremendous amount of money in the last 5 years, $27.7 billion in the past 5 years. So it's not as if they said, we're going to acquire this rather than invest. They can't do that. I mean, their competitors, the phone companies, the wireless providers, they're all investing.
Well, let me make the question simpler.
Okay.
Is it your position that there will be more innovation from the merger than there would if the resources used in the merger were simply used to develop technology directly?
There'll be more innovation from the merger.
I mean, there's a sense in which Comcast is telling the public, if you want some really great stuff by way of technological development and innovation, then you got to let us merge, because it's not going to happen if we don't merge.
Here's what I will say. Time Warner Cable customers will have a better experience and will have more innovation through this merger than if things had gone on as they were. That is true. I mean, you can just look at the enhancement to internet, high-speed internet that Comcast has. I mean, they're ahead of Time Warner Cable. Their operating system, their Wi-Fi hotspots, all of that stuff. And this is going to be an improvement to Time Warner Cable customers. You're sort of asking me an impossible hypothetical question. But there are clear benefits to the acquired company's customers that result from this merger. While at the same time, there's no doubt that Comcast has done a tremendous amount of investment and innovation in the last 5 years and will continue to do so. There's no question about that. I mean, you just think about it. Like, I'm a cable customer, I don't know if you, but we have now DVRs that can record multiple programs at the same time. The whole experience is much more seamless, and it's clear that the product has improved. There's no question about that. But certain cable companies are ahead of others, and clearly Comcast is ahead of Time Warner Cable. So it'll bring those benefits to the Time Warner Cable customers, which I think is the only relevant test for the FCC. I don't even think this is a relevant test for the Justice Department. But for the FCC and looking at whether or not it is in the public interest.
Well, it's not relevant for the Justice Department. Why? Because it's not merger specific?
It's not merger specific.
But let me ask you, are the benefits that are touted by the parties, you know, the various things that you named, sort of side benefits, investments, socially conscious, are those merger specific?
Well, they're merger specific in the sense, like the Internet Essentials program, that's something that Comcast is required to do, and now Time Warner Cable customers will have the benefit, low-income Time Warner Cable customers will have the benefit of that program. So in that sense, but I think this discussion is getting us away from the antitrust inquiry. The antitrust inquiry is there, or may there tend to be a significant harm, a substantial harm to competition. That's why arguing about whether it would be better if it was that, or better if it was this, That's not really relevant for the Justice Department, for an antitrust enforcer. Just look at the facts of this merger.
Well, your answer to that is look at the consumers, look at the choices they have. My answer to that is that's the wrong market, the critic's answer, I should say.
Sure.
That's the wrong market. You got to look upstream. It's about firepower, and you're basically saying, well, I don't see that as a big competition problem either. Let me ask you this question. I'd like your views on what you think the net effect of the merger will be on investment and returns in the video and broadband technology space.
I mean, I think the net effect of the merger will be good. I've quoted to you the figures about what Comcast has been investing. But think about what the other companies, their competitors, are going to be investing. I mean, we have Randall Stephenson of AT&T, and I'm looking up the quote, who said, let me get the quote before I make sure I don't misquote him, which I don't want to do. But he said, in competing with cable, he said in the Wall Street Journal, it's going to be a dogfight between us and cable for the next 20 years. They will invest, and they will step up. We will invest. It will go back and forth. I mean, we can sit around here and speculate. This is the CEO of one of the largest telecom companies in the country. And clearly Comcast has been investing. So why will that happen? I mean, why do they do this? They do this because they want to stay a step ahead or stay up with their competitors. By making Comcast a stronger competitor, offering better services to more customers, it's going to force the telephone companies, the wired telephone companies like an AT&T, the wireless companies to invest, and the wireless companies to invest. We haven't even talked about a company like Google, which is now expanding its fiber to 9 more markets. They have plans to do that. I mean, absolutely. I think the record is this kind of thing is going to spur innovation and investment in the whole telecom, broadband, cable infrastructure. No question about it.
We have a question from a listener, it refers to a statement that was made on our last call with Dr. Moss, where she was looking at pricing and data delivery through the lens of international benchmarks, the performance of cable and broadband providers in other countries. The questioner points out that you're citing U.S.-specific facts to talk about Comcast's technology and costs. Do you think the U.S. numbers are a better guide than other countries where there's a broader sort of palette of technologies and companies to look at?
Well, I mean, we're talking about a merger in the United States, so what's happening in the U.S. market is relevant. But I mean, if you want to compare what's going on around the world, I think the idea that the U.S. is lagging behind is really a canard. I don't think it's really true. So there's some statistics here. The ITU, the International
Telecommunications Union,
found that the U.S. has the OECD's most affordable entry-level broadband. And the FCC has found that the OECD has the third lowest price per gigabyte of wired broadband. This doesn't sound like...
So what is entry-level? Is that DSL?
I don't know. I'm reading statistics. I don't know exactly.
We're not sure what it is. Okay,
but you know, I'd have to go back and go to the source. But those are both... I guess it's the lowest price. I mean, I don't think it necessarily has to be DSL, but it's probably the lowest speed of high-speed broadband.
So you take issue with the fact that critics say that folks in South Korea and Sweden and Finland are doing better by way of...
Akamai has found that the U.S. is ranked in the top 10 globally on average peak and high broadband, above 10 megabyte speeds. The University of Pennsylvania found using FCC and EU data, found a far greater share of U.S. households, 82%, have access to next-generation networks, which they define as 25 megabytes and more, than in Europe, which is 54%. Innovation, I'm getting a little bit off your point, but the same University of Pennsylvania study found that per household broadband investment in the U.S. was $562 per household, more than twice that in Europe, which is $244. And then on local, and this is the final statistic I'll give you, total traffic per user, which is a good measure of innovation through utilization, U.S. users consume 50% more bandwidth than European users. I have all the statistics. I think it's not really true, which was often repeated, that Europe or Asia is far ahead of us. And then finally, and a lot of people talk about this, if we're talking about a country like Korea or Japan, it's a much smaller area, much denser population than the United States. I mean, population density per square mile or square kilometer is much, much higher in those countries, or Denmark, population density in the area. And so you got to make an apples-to-apples comparison. We're talking about a continental country with the Rocky Mountains and deserts and really remote areas, and to wire that country, it's
a big
country. It's a big country. Yeah. It's much more difficult. So I would point to that as well.
Fair enough. What impact, if any, do you see from the proposed AT&T DirecTV merger on the competitive analysis of this deal? And what's your view of the AT&T?
I'll give you my view, but I have to be careful because Comcast doesn't have any view on the merger. When I talk about my, I'm just talking about my view. But you know, in terms of the first point, I mean, I think each merger has to be evaluated on its own. You know, and Comcast was in first, and they can't control what other companies do. But the Justice Department and the FCC's got to look at the market as it is when they, you know, when they announce their merger, or today. And I don't think there's a great deal of impact. Also, other markets are affected by that. You know, but I see the AT&T DirecTV merger as more problematic. This is again just me speaking, because you have direct competition there. You have direct video competition between the AT&T U-verse and DirecTV. And okay, that's just 25% of the country. But it is 25% of the country. That's not a small part of the country. And there it's going down. If you consider two satellites, one incumbent cable, and telco, it's going down from 4 to 3. That's something that the DOJ is going to have to look at very carefully. We saw how they looked at a 4 to 3 merger in AT&T T-Mobile. I think I'm not saying that it's going to get blocked. I just think it raises more competition concerns than this one does, certainly.
But you don't see, I gather from your answer, any kind of impact or consideration that needs to be given to the fact that merger is proposed and pending in connection with the review of Comcast Time Warner.
In 75% of the country, on the video side, it's not, even if it was approved, it wouldn't have any impact. It wouldn't change the landscape. I guess if it was approved, then there'd be one less competitive alternative. But I think the way a regulator can't really look at it that way. A regulator has to look at the merger as is. I mean, just look, we saw in the airline industry, we saw a tremendous number of mergers. We saw Continental United, Delta Northwest, AirTran Southwest, and then all of a sudden American U.S. Airways came along, and the Justice Department initially at least filed a lawsuit to block it. And I'm sure that they said, what happened here? Each one was considered individually. And those were actually all merged in the same industry. And as I say here, other than that overlap between DirecTV and AT&T U-verse in that 25% of the country, it's really not the same industry. AT&T's wired service because there's not a video competition in the other 75%, and there's not broadband competition because DirecTV doesn't have really broadband because of the technological difficulties of going into space. So, in other words, there's not really the impact. But I was making the comparison to the airline market, where it clearly was the same kind of merger, yet the analysis changed. And when they were looking at Continental United, they didn't say, well, next might come American U.S. Airways, so we've got to be careful here. I mean, likewise, you could say the same thing in the cell phone market. You know, AT&T and Singular merged, and Verizon and Altel merged, and Sprint and Nextel merged, and then we had AT&T T-Mobile. And
those A bridge too far.
My point is that you look at each merger as it comes along, not you say we have this group of things coming in, one, you know, something, and we got to all lump them together. I don't think that's really the proper way of analyzing it from that.
Isn't that really the answer then to the question about a limiting principle? Couldn't you say then in the same respect, this merger's okay, but another one might be a bridge too far?
Well, that's sure. You could. Absolutely. That's why I say it's not the merger before us.
Is this a good way to do merger review?
This is a good way to do it. I don't know any other way you're going to do merger review.
Well, another way would be to consider larger industry trends, consider having to face the next request for a review of a merger, that sort of thing, instead of insisting upon merger-specific review. And the reason that it might be relevant is because of the emergence of oligopoly in so many sectors.
Mm-hmm. Well, the problem is, I mean, you identify a problem, but the problem is that merger review can't be speculative. It has to be based on the facts and the markets at issue. We have a specific statute, you know, Section 7 of the Clayton Act that we're construing here.
There's not a lot of scope for doing what I'm
suggesting. If we had a different statute these agencies have to follow the law. And
right.
If we had a different statute that said don't allow a merger that may substantially injure competition, and be aware of what might happen in the future.
Industrial policy, right.
It's not industrial policy.
Okay, well then I'll continue on that track, even though we'll agree that that's not how things are at the moment,
right.
And ask you what effect you see from the transaction with regard to the long-run direction of the industry. And in particular, does the merger make the what's been called the walled garden model of TV everywhere, internet delivery of video programming, more likely than the more open field model of Netflix and Amazon?
No. I don't think it does make it more likely. And the reason I say that is because, you know, maybe you could have had that concern in 1998 or something, but today with the development of the internet and online video and so many consumers accessing video content through Netflix or Apple TV or you name it, Amazon Prime, how is there a walled garden? I mean, people can opt out of this whole system, and many millions of consumers do. I read you the statistics on the drop of cable subscribers.
Well, you're not suggesting that Netflix competes with Comcast video services, are you?
I may be suggesting that. Actually, I may be.
But if you need Comcast to get Netflix, then what kind of competition is that?
Well,
really?
That's a different thing. You don't need Comcast video service to get Netflix.
No, you need Comcast broadband.
But you don't need Comcast broadband because you can go to Verizon Fios broadband.
If you're in that 16% of the country that has Verizon or something.
Or AT&T UVerse. Mm-hmm. Or you can go to everywhere. You can go to the DSL product and get Netflix.
Is DSL capable of giving you Netflix?
As long as you get 3 megabytes downstream, you can get an HD on Netflix, and as long as you get, I think it's 850 kilobytes. I've got the statistic here somewhere, but I've got a lot of papers in front of me.
No problem. I can
dig it out. But yes, in fact, it is possible. And in fact, you shouldn't generalize from one person, but I have viewed Netflix using Verizon DSL.
Okay.
I've watched House of Cards.
And you also think wireless is substitutable.
I didn't even mention wireless, but absolutely. And they go into any airport today and watch people sitting down waiting for an airplane. They're watching Netflix. And a lot of time they're doing it through a Wi-Fi connection at the airport. Sometimes it's stored on their iPad. But a lot of times it's not.
That's Wi-Fi, right? That's
okay,
not
that's
4G
that's,
wireless or...
That's fair,
or
but also it might be. It might be a network connection. Who knows if it's Wi-Fi or who knows if it's a network connection that they're paying data for.
You know that's very expensive, right?
Well, actually, it's not if you're a Sprint subscriber.
Yeah, well, okay.
Data is, there's no extra charge for data.
Okay.
So, and by the way, Sprint's a client of mine. That's not really a commercial for Sprint, but it's just a fact. I think there are, you don't have to go through Comcast to get, and Comcast doesn't serve the whole country, right? So there's other cable. If you live in Fairfax County, you're going to go through Cox to get your if you want a cable broadband. So no, I just don't accept this walled garden notion today in the internet world that we live in today.
Yeah, I mean the walled garden comes, of course, from the fact that the TV everywhere setup requires you to be a MVPD subscriber.
That's right, TV everywhere does, but you don't have to get content if you're getting content that's not TV, and that's not the only way to get that content because that generally just extends to certain windows. But once you get past the windows, if it's a year later, then you can see that content outside of the TV Everywhere concept.
Sure. So a question from our audience asked a little bit about somewhere that has to do with this interconnect business. It's complicated, but let's see your reaction to it. The question the question asks, do you think whether the merger will give Comcast a greater ability to determine the price for companies? And I assume he's referring to application providers to get on the fast lane to get to consumers.
Well, this is a long and complicated story. We're coming to the end of the call, so I don't really have time to get into it, I don't think, fully. But, I mean, there are many sort of freeways to reach Comcast through interconnections, through CDN networks. And this is referring to Netflix. The problem was that Netflix, which is about a third of the traffic, wasn't willing to do that and wanted sort of to deliver itself to Comcast and wanted to do it for free. So eventually they had to come to some kind of terms. But I think, no, it doesn't give Comcast the ability to dictate the price because there are many ways to get to the Comcast network. And that's a very competitive marketplace.
Well, the Comcast is not charging them to deliver. Comcast wanted to be their CDN and didn't want a third party to be their CDN. They wanted the business, right?
Own CDN.
Yes, it did, and
right.
Comcast didn't want that. Isn't that what happened?
Well, because Comcast,
why should you be the CDN if I can be the CDN?
Well, Comcast exchanged traffic with all kinds of folks.
Sure.
And that's not the situation that Netflix was in. And they wanted to work out a commercially reasonable arrangement, as they do for so many other
cable companies.
So many other people that deliver via the internet.
Yeah.
But Netflix was asking to be outside that system.
Well, okay, fair enough. We're getting sort of close to the end of it. Did you? Is there something that you want to sort of make sure that you get across about the Comcast?
No, I think I pretty much made my point. I'm happy to take another question.
Well, I was just thinking in general, what's the feeling about the industry? You pointed out there's a lot of popular opposition, but Dish came out with a. There was an article in the Times this morning about Dish is sending a letter to the FCC against the merger. I'm sure there's a lot of counterparties to Comcast who might be uncomfortable with the merger, but they're not saying anything about it. How do Comcast counterparties feel about the deal?
Well, I don't work for Comcast, so I'm not in business negotiations with these people.
Okay.
But I think it's not really true that the industry is wildly opposed to it. And, for example, if I can pull out a quote, I'm sorry I'm doing this, but I have a quote. If I can't pull out the president of here it is, president of 21st Century Fox, not a small media company,
mm-hmm.
Chase Carey said that, he said this, let me get the date on this, in an earnings call on February 6th of this year, we honestly don't see any material consequences to our business from cable consolidation. In fact, there may be some positive ones. First, unique content and scale in an expanding digital world has never had a stronger hand. So, second, new digital platforms and over-the-top players may grow even more quickly with the consolidated distribution industry. Furthermore, the real industry is how many choices an individual home has, not how big the distributor. And so anyway, he went on and on. I mean, there's a pretty strong statement from him. And
of the benefits of having consolidated.
Right. So, I mean, I think you have to be... you have to be balanced here, and in considering this, I also wanted to point out that one other prominent industry player, the president of the Ovation Network came out in support of this. I don't accept the fact that that the industry is just wildly opposed to this. And
I'm not sure that they're coming out wildly opposed to it either. I was trying to get your views on what you've heard or observed about industry reaction.
I'm not privy to industry discussions and negotiations,
right.
But I know what people say publicly, and those are two examples of what people say publicly. So in terms of the recent Dish Network filing, which I guess was just yesterday.
Yeah.
I mean, again, that's a competitor, and if one has to be suspicious of a competitor expressing concerns because they're obviously concerned if there's a stronger competitor. But consumers benefit from there being a stronger competitor.
Let me close the interview with a final question. I'm interested in where the benefits of this merger are really going to be felt. Obviously, Comcast is a private company. It's in business to make money and to grow its shareholders' interests.
Mm-hmm.
But by the same token, one of the Comcast executives said that after the merger, they didn't expect prices to necessarily go down and maybe not go up as fast. Why aren't consumers going to share in the benefits of the merger in terms of lower prices?
Well, okay. First of all, we can't make predictions about price. If we're talking about prices, though, I gave you statistics about how over less than 10 years, cable programming costs went up over 120%, more than twice, significantly more than twice. With greater scale, Comcast is going to be able to negotiate better deals. So if they can restrain the cost of programming, that should benefit consumers. There's number one. But it's not just about price. It's also about quality of service. And as I said earlier, all the Time Warner customers are going to get the benefits of the technological improvements that Comcast offers, the higher speed broadband, the X1 operating system.
Well, couldn't any suitor do that with Time Warner? If another cable company bought Time Warner and decided to invest in improving its infrastructure, would have the same effect,
well,
right?
I don't know that any other competitors. Comcast is basically the industry leader. I don't know that any other competitor could do this, or would have the scale necessary to do this. So no, I don't know if that's true. But I do know, or do expect, that this is true for Comcast. And not to mention getting the benefits of the Open Internet Order, getting the benefits of the Internet Essentials Program, which is already over 1.2 million people have the benefits of that. Not to be scoffed at, low-income people getting access to the Internet at under $10 a month. And as important as the Internet is to education today and accessing all kinds of services, I think there are a lot of benefits that consumers are going to reap from this. And this is the reason that under the SEC public interest test, it's going to pass the SEC public interest test. So as I said, I don't think there's a competition issue, but it's also under the SEC standards, it also is a merger that definitely should pass muster.
Well, as the merging parties might say, this has really been Comcastic.
Thank you for that.
And that's all the time we have, I'm afraid. Mr. Bloom, thanks so much for participating in our conference call series on Comcast Time Warner. If you'd like the audio of this call, just email us at editorial@thecapitalforum.com. And thanks to everyone who participated today. Have a wonderful weekend, and that will conclude our call.
Thank you very much.